Hello and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who went a little too hard this holidays. Anyways, we're your hosts. That's Brie.
And that's Angie. I mean, is that a such thing to go too hard? I don't know. But today we're going to be talking about, ironically, cell phone location data and criminal prosecutions. Not that we have any personal stories to share after the holidays, but you never know. But this is our first in a series that we are releasing in 2025 called Foul, that's spelled F-O-W-L, Foul Play, where we discuss the intersection of e-discovery, legal tech, and crime.
That's right. And today we are so, so lucky to be joined by my former colleague, King County Senior Deputy Prosecuting Attorney David Bannock. David, apart from being my dear friend, is a very impressive person. With over 50 criminal trials under his belt, David is an absolute ace in the courtroom, and I would know because I have actually co-tried cases with him. He currently works in the Sexually Violent Predator Unit for the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, where he civilly commits especially dangerous offenders. Before that, David worked in the Domestic Violence Unit, where he tried Class A felony trials and was part of a task force whose mission was to confiscate guns from people accused of crimes of domestic violence. And before that, David prosecuted violent crimes, crimes involving gang activity, and was in charge of hate crimes. He's also worked with some very high-level FBI personnel to use cell phone data in a handful of cases. And more about all of that in today's episode. But for now, welcome, David. We are so thrilled to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here. And it's so fun to be with Angie again. We started our career as baby attorneys together. So it's a lot of fun.
We did. We've come a long way from the days of sharing a wall that was literally infested with rodents.
Yeah. Literally.
Whoa. What? No.
In district court.
Oh, and there were ants too. And I remember like bringing it up to services and they were like, well, are the ants hurting you? And we were like, no.
Not yet.
Not yet. Yeah. Okay. So we've come a long way from sharing a wall with ants. We had a lot of creature issues at our first job together.
The world of criminal district court is a lot different than our lives now. So we're very lucky.
Yeah, we also had a squirrel thing.
A lot of squirrels.
Like real squirrels, not the ones that we're just always chasing ourselves when we can't stay on task, like the real squirrels. Okay.
Real actual squirrels.
Interesting.
Things you didn't know about working for the government.
All right. Well, you know, Angie, you were mentioning that we kind of hit it hard this holiday. I mean, is this like true confession time? I mean, what? I'm a little bit afraid about what we're going to discuss.
I'll start with some very G-rated holiday stories. I did something unprecedented this holiday season. I actually baked cookies.
Oh.
Which is not, I actually don't know that I have ever baked cookies.
Really?
Uh-huh. I'm about to be 5.
I'm so proud of you for, you know, branching out, moving into the cookie world.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really living on the edge now.
So did they come out okay? Were you happy with them?
Yeah, they were kind of weird, but, you know, for first, maybe I had beginner's luck.
I don't know.
What are some of your holiday things?
Ooh, well, my wife, Laura, makes gingerbread cookies and she makes way too many of them. And so I try to eat less than 2 per day.
That's actually a very valiant goal.
Which is my goal. I don't always succeed. And then both of our families are around here in Seattle. So we just do stuff around here. Nothing too exciting.
I love to make cookies at the holiday and I usually go way too overboard. But they kind of remind me, it's like I have cookie recipes from like my mom, from the neighbor next door growing up, from my grandma. And like every time that I make that person's recipe, I get to think about them and like my memories with them. So that's kind of nice.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Yeah, but that could be nice.
It was just from the New York Times, so I don't have any kind of personal connection.
Well, you get to make your own memories with that recipe.
I guess so. Well, all right. Should we talk cell phone data?
I guess so. But before we get going, there's a quick trigger warning I just want to mention. In today's episode, we'll talk about fact patterns and crimes that may be disturbing to some listeners. There will be references to domestic violence, kidnapping, and shooting. To protect those affected by these crimes, we won't be using names or other identifiers. But if these topics are challenging for you, please do what feels right for you, whether that's soldiering through, skipping ahead, or just passing up on today's episode. I promise we will not judge you for it, and we'll be here for the next one. As always, your mental health is extremely important, so protect it. And with all of that, let's talk cell phone location data, Angie and
let's
David.
Do it. I'm so excited about this.
All right. So as we dive in, I thought it would be good to kind of set the table a little bit. I want to distinguish today's conversation between civil and criminal cases, because today we're going to be talking more on the criminal side of life. But if you're like me, a lot of my experience is with civil matters. So many times working in a corporation or with clients in house, we're dealing with those civil matters. And by civil, I mean company versus company or employee versus company. The type of forensic data we most likely get from cell phones would consist of logical, like anything that a user creates on their cell phone, like their active data or user creative data is what we call it sometimes. Or we might be doing a full collection of a phone. So in addition to the logical data that we would get, we're also getting like the systems, the directories, the deleted data. And that's a forensic data collection is what we call it on that device. Those types of collections that I have done traditionally, and if anybody else has the same experience, you probably have seen this too. We're looking at things like call history, text message content, app data, pictures, files, etc. All right, so we know that world. In today's conversation, we're even expanding our horizons even more thanks to David and his expertise. We're going to be concentrating on criminal matters, like the criminal versus the government. That's handled by prosecutors who present the government's case and criminal defense attorneys who represent the interest of the defendant. You'll see what that includes here in a minute, but it's a little bit of a different perspective. And David, thank you for being here.
Of course, it's one of the most interesting and fun things we get to do in criminal law. So I'm excited to talk about it.
I know. All right. Well, let's start asking you questions. I want to start by setting the stage here because there's a little bit of mystery around cell phone location data. We hear about it a lot of times in pop culture, on podcasts like Serial and shows like Forensic Files or The Jinx. And all of that hype can give this a real sort of like deus ex machina checkmate flavor. But let's level set. What location data can you actually get from cell phones and how precise is it?
So that's a great question. And what I think a lot of people are surprised by is that the location data that we get for cell phones is not actually from the cell phones. It's from the cell phone service providers. And so what that means is that police officers and prosecutors and law enforcement don't ever even have to seize the actual phone to find out where that phone has been. So instead, we get that information from cell phone providers like T-Mobile, Verizon, et cetera. And they give us that information and then we figure out how to use it.
So what types of data are of it? Like what can you actually get from these cell phone providers? And when you say cell phone providers, that's like Verizon, AT&T, things like that, right?
Yeah, they're these massive companies and they hold all this data. And I want to be clear too, they don't hold this data for police or for law enforcement. They have other reasons to know how well their cell towers are working, how well their connections are working. But that same data that they use is helpful to law enforcement too in solving crimes, corroborating victims' testimony, and figuring out what really happened. So there's kind of two types of data traditionally that we can get from cell phone service providers. The first is called call detail records. And call detail records are something that we've traditionally gotten for many years from cell phone service providers. And it's a little bit hard to explain, but you can think of these cell phone towers that we see all around us. There's many of them. There's probably more than you think. And each cell phone tower has three sides. And when a cell phone interacts with a tower and gets a signal, it interacts with one of these three sides. And each of those three sides of the cell phone tower has a service area that goes out in a pie shape. So as it gets farther and farther away from the cell phone tower, that area expands and gets wider. And what call detail records give us is a spot somewhere in that pie shape where a cell phone might have been at a particular time. And so it's not a super accurate point of where somebody was or where a cell phone was, but we know generally where somebody was. And so that's traditionally what prosecutors and law enforcement have used. But now there's another kind of data that's being used more often. And that's called timing advance records. And timing advance records work very practically. And to understand them, you have to kind of understand a couple things about cell phone towers. Cell phone signals, when they communicate between a phone and a tower, they don't all reach the tower at the same time. They actually reach it sequentially based on how far away they are from that tower. And so you can think of it like a line of cell phone pings that are all arriving at the tower sequentially at a slightly different time, separated by microseconds. And those cell phone signals travel at a constant rate. So when we get that measurement of time that a cell phone has to get to a tower and then back to the cell phone, we can triangulate exactly where that cell phone is located. And when I say exactly, I'm not talking about, you know, to the inch or to the foot, but we're able to tell if someone's in a house, we're able to tell if someone's in a park, we're able to tell with some accuracy where a cell phone is, which is incredibly helpful in solving crimes and proving crimes and figuring out what happened, which is kind of one of our main jobs.
So if you're standing, like imagine you as a person with your cell phone, you're standing somewhere and your phone pings off of a couple different towers. And we know how long it takes down to the nanosecond to ping on those towers. So you kind of are like doing backwards math to figure out where that is located. Is that kind of right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's backwards math. And thank God it's not math that I have to do. we'll get into a little later how the data comes in and what we do with it. But that's essentially what the data says. And the reason the cell phone companies have that data, I should say, is because they need to know how well their cell phone towers are working. They need to know, you know, whether they need to put in another tower. So they need to know all this stuff. And it just so happens that that information retrofitted is really important for law enforcement too. So that's why we use it.
Well, I bet they sell it to apps and stuff. Like when I go on Google Maps and it's like, explore nearby.
How do you know where I am? Is there an amount of time, like a retention period of sorts, that a cell phone company has to keep this data for?
Yes, normally it's kept for about 2 years. And I don't know. I don't think that's actually based on a law. I think that's just the normal retention period for most of these companies. And so we can't go super far back in time to solve a crime based on cell phone data that occurred 10 years ago. So when we figure out that we need this data, we try to request it up front if we can in order to use it.
That's very interesting. So assuming that we want this data, and we're going to get into more detail about why we'd want it in here in a little bit, but assuming we want it, where does the data live?
Yes, so this data lives on the cloud, essentially, in great big folders kept by these cell phone companies. And I guess on their servers as well, if they keep it on servers. But it's held by these cell phone companies, and it's up to us to figure out, what do we need to request in order to prove whether a crime occurred or not? And once we figure that out, then we can use it.
So when we are retrieving this data from a cloud and from cell phone carriers, what is the process? And just to kind of, you know, compare apples to oranges, like I was mentioning earlier, in civil matters, we think of using a service provider or software to pull data from a device or go to the service provider to, or go to the cell phone carrier to get call records or that sort of thing. But this is different. So what does that workflow look like when you're getting the data from T-Mobile or AT&T or Verizon?
So in criminal law, we have search warrants. And a lot of people know what a search warrant is, but it's basically a document that's drafted by law enforcement and issued by a judge that authorizes law enforcement to search either a location, a person, or for property of evidence of a crime. And in order to write that search warrant and make sure that it gets granted, the search warrant has to include a couple of things. It has to include probable cause, which is basically proven by an affidavit written by a police officer that explains what crime occurred and that there's probable cause to believe that the defendant occurred the actual crime. It has to include particularity, which is a fancy way of saying that we can't search for everything. We have to search for something tailored and specific. So if I'm writing a search warrant for cell phone location data, I can't request all the location information of somebody for the past 5 years. I have to focus it on a specific day and probably to a specific couple of hours to make sure I'm only searching for things that I actually need. And then there has to be a nexus. So what a nexus is in criminal law is it's a link between the actual crime and the information we're searching. So we have to explain in the search warrant application why we want this information, how it will help us prove or disprove that a crime occurred. And if all that is present, then a judge signs off on the search warrant, and then it becomes a court order and it's sent to these cell phone companies or to whoever we're sending the search warrant to, and they're required to send the information to law enforcement within a specific amount of time.
So what about in cases like, hey, I need to keep consistent track of this Yahoo who's doing some shenanigans or whatever, or accused of shenanigans. How do I constantly monitor somebody? Do I have to go back to the court over and over and over again? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We're able to make these warrants to look at historical location data, but we can also use a slightly different type of warrant to find someone's current and updated location information. And this is used a lot of different situations where, let's say, a shooting or a murder has occurred, and we think we know who did it, and we know their cell phone number, but we can't find them. We can't arrest them because we have no idea where they are. In the past, this person would have escaped pretty easily and could have left the state or left the country and avoided arrest. But now we can do these kinds of warrants to the cell phone company. We call it a trap and trace warrant. And what happens once we get it approved is T-Mobile or Verizon or whatever cell phone company it is will email the police the updated information of where someone is exactly through timing advance records to law enforcement. I've also used this not only in finding people who were looking for to arrest, but I've also used it in cases where I've had a witness who doesn't want to testify in court and we need to get them in or else maybe my case is going to be dismissed. So I need to know where they are. Maybe they haven't picked up their phone in a long time. I can use this trap and trace warrant to find out exactly where they are so that we can hopefully bring them in voluntarily if we can.
I know you said your phone pings against different phone towers. Is it always doing that? Sometimes doing that? Like, what's the trigger that makes your phone do that pinging?
Good question. And I should have mentioned this earlier. So this information is so much more accurate now because of the ways our cell phones work compared to how they used to work. So in the past, your cell phone, and I'm talking maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, but less and less now, your cell phone would only communicate with a tower when it made a phone call or it sent a text message. And so you can imagine that's a lot less pings. Someone could not make a phone call for a long time and then we wouldn't know exactly where they were. But now your cell phones are almost always communicating with towers every couple of minutes. Anytime you have an app open in the background of your phone, your cell phone is communicating with a tower. So
like any app?
Pretty much any app. Like if you're like me, you have Google Maps open to the last place you went sometimes on your cell phone. That means your phone is constantly communicating with a tower. Most people do that. Not everybody does that. But what that means is that when we get this data, we don't just have a couple of pings for someone's day every time they made a call. We have a path of exactly where they've been, exactly where they're going. And we can get that live information because our phones are just always communicating with towers these days.
Wow, that's it. I'm going to go back to using a beeper.
We say no to a brick.
Do it.
So when you are getting the information that is the subject of your search warrant that was granted by the judge, what format is this data in? And is there a process of kind of normalizing that? And I'm saying that term because it's what we use with civil e-discovery. When we get data, we have to normalize it, put it in a database so it's all reviewable. How does this look in your world?
Yeah, so the format that it comes in is an insane, huge spreadsheet that is really hard to interpret. Yeah, it's very gross. It has columns, some columns that take a long time to understand. It has some columns that indicate latitude and longitude, which you're not going to know unless you plug it into something. It has a column with exact time and exact seconds, but sometimes you have to change the time zone to really understand what that means. And again, there are many, many columns. There's only a couple people I've ever met that can take a look at those spreadsheets and actually make anything of them without using software. And so what we use and what law enforcement uses is a software that we just plug these Excel sheets into and they create maps, which is pretty amazing because that's what we want. And we don't have time often to sit down and take out a big fold-out map and figure out where these things are. We need a quickly generated map. And that's what this software does. And once we generate that, we have pings on a map, just like you would see on Google Maps. And we can zoom in and see exactly what locations this cell phone is at.
How often do you ask for this data? Like how many cases are you applying for a search warrant to get it?
I would say in most serious class A felonies, we're seeking this data. Now there's times when it's less important. The times when it's really important are when identification is at issue. So if we've found a body or someone who's been shot or injured, and we don't know who did it, but we think we might know. Let's say we have them on video, or we have someone, a witness saying that it might have been this person. We need to verify that that's correct. And so the way that we verify that that's correct and help provide additional proof is by getting this warrant. If we have a case where we know 100% who did it because the person was caught there committing the crime, let's say on video camera, we don't need to know their cell phone location because we know they did it.
Right.
Anytime there is some doubt and anytime we need to corroborate what we believe is happening, we'll get this data in order to prove most of our serious cases.
Have you ever gotten this data and then decided against prosecuting a case or something like that? Like, has this ever exculpated someone?
Absolutely. It definitely has. And so that would most of the time happen at the pre-filing stage. We think we have probable cause that someone committed a crime, but we're not sure. And we get the data and it shows that the cell phone was nowhere near the crime scene. We've also had cases where the data we get is harmful to us. So let's say someone left their cell phone at home and went out and committed the crime. The person may still have committed the crime, but that information is not good. It seems to say that the person never went to the crime scene. And so we have that situation too. Most of the time it is helpful, but ultimately what it helps is it gets us closer to the truth, which is what we want in criminal law.
Yeah. And so in speaking about the process of obtaining the data in the first place, how hard is it to have your warrant approved by a judge? Is that a difficult process or is it willy-nilly? Everybody gets one, you get one, everybody gets one.
Oprah, you get a warrant.
Thankfully, it's not that hard. You know, we write these warrants a lot. And, you know, I have certain officers who might write 5 of these per week, you know, investigating cases. And so we know how to write them. We know what judges are looking for. So I would say they get approved over 90% of the time that we submit them. And often if they're not approved, there's some edits we need to make. And then we make those and then they're approved. So thankfully, it's a process where we get the data we want most of the time.
Because you can get it, like because it's available, have you found that there's an expectation that you will get it? And if so, how do you feel about that?
Yeah. And surprisingly, we do have an expectation that we will get it. A search warrant is a legal order by a judge. And so these companies have to send us this data. If they don't, they could be held in contempt of court. And so what these companies have done, and a lot of tech companies have done, they've set up their own legal departments where their sole job is to respond to these law enforcement requests. You know, you ask how I feel about it. And the way I feel about it is, you know, of course, this is someone's private information. This should not be public information. It should not be given to everybody. But I also think that, you know, our job in law enforcement is to uncover the truth. And this is one of the most important tools. And there's now an expectation of jurors that we are going to get this data because they know that we can get it. I think we should uncover this stuff as much as possible to try to figure out what truly happened.
All right. So once you get this data, you've mentioned this, like you don't just sit on it, you actually go and use it. And since the focus of today's episode is trial, let's start there. In trial, you can't just show evidence to a jury. There's a vetting process beforehand during which you admit, that's the term of art, you admit evidence. So David, what is admissibility and how do you admit this evidence at trial?
So at a 30,000 foot level, admissibility refers to the legal standards and rules that determine whether a particular piece of evidence can be introduced to a jury. So pretty much everything that we show the jury, it has to be admissible under the rules of evidence. And the judge makes that call. They consider whether the evidence is relevant, whether it's reliable, whether it'd be fair or misleading to show to the jury. And if you want to prove this and get this, you know, shown to the jury, you have to meet these kind of baseline standards. So one of the things that you have to do to admit this type of evidence, which is cell phone location data, is you need a business records custodian. And a business records custodian is a person typically from the company that you're getting the information from, that will testify to basically five steps. But basically, they'll say, I work for T-Mobile. These are records that we keep. These records are reliable for these reasons. And these records show cell phone location data. That's really important. First of all, you know, it's important for admissibility. If we didn't have that person, we couldn't admit these records at all. But it's also important just to help explain to the jury what information they're about to hear. And that this isn't just something that we made up or fabricated with law enforcement or anything like that. We have someone from T-Mobile saying, these are the records. And so it adds a lot of credibility. We also have to prove that the records are obtained through lawful means. In order for us to get these lawfully, we already talked about the search warrant. The search warrant has to be done correctly. But the other thing to think about for location data is the cell phone number. We have to get the cell phone number lawfully too. Usually that's, you know, someone telling us someone's cell phone number, but we can't do
it. Like a witness or something?
Like a witness or something like that. But what we can't do is we can't get it from a government database, for example, related to healthcare. We can't just look it up, you know, through all the government resources that we have. We have to find out what someone's cell phone number is. Not everybody keeps the same cell phone number all the time either. And so sometimes that's a difficult hurdle, and we have to make sure that that's done correctly and lawfully. Otherwise, we can't do any of this.
Interesting. So once you get the data admitted, how do you use it? Do you just hand it over to the jury? Does somebody have to interpret it? Do you make demonstratives? Like, what does this look like in a courtroom?
Thankfully, we don't just hand it over to the jury because, as I said before, this data makes no sense when it's on spreadsheets. So what we do is we get an expert witness. This is a specific type of expert witness who is almost always for us a law enforcement officer who is trained in cell phone location data, can help interpret the data on the spreadsheets, has access to licensed software to create maps for us, and can kind of explain some of the science behind how cell phones work. Unfortunately for us, there's not that many people that have that level of expertise. Many law enforcement offices that I work with have one, if at all, person that knows how to do this kind of testimony. And so in my experience, we've gone to the FBI because the FBI has a department of officers that specifically do this kind of thing. So it's cool to get to work with them on some of this stuff, our federal partners. They use it a lot. One of the agents that I got to work with at the FBI is an agent named Agent Eric Perry. He has worked on the Aaron Hernandez case. He's worked on the Robert Durst case from the Jinx. He worked on the Idaho murders case as well of the college students. And then he came to testify on one of my cases. So it's a good way to meet really smart people in the field also.
So you're also famous. Okay, got it.
Probably one of the less famous cases that he did.
Talk to me about visual aids, because I remember when I was trial paralegal, that was a huge part of trying to explain the story to a jury, because it's like, great, we broke down the spreadsheets, we got this like badass guy from the FBI who told us what the truth is. But like, how can I see the story? How do I know what you're trying to communicate to me in a way that's meaningful? What have been some ways that you've done that?
I think visual aids in criminal trials are some of the most important things you can do, whether it's making a timeline, making charts or graphs. The jury needs to see something. They don't just want to hear what someone said happened. And they definitely don't want to look at spreadsheets. So what I do is before trial, I work with our expert to build a deck of slides, basically, that are super, super clear. I always have a series of slides that explain what this information is, showing pictures of cell phone towers, showing information about how cell phone towers work, so that the expert can kind of explain how this all works, as we've explained today. And then I really focus in on maps. I try to make the maps easy to understand. If I have location data from several different cell phones, I'll use different colors and different symbols to indicate different people. And we'll zoom in and we'll zoom out so that people can look at and see landmarks that they're familiar with, so they can really understand where these locations are. The best kind of finished product for this is when it shows before the crime, during the crime, and after the crime. So let's say this is a shooting where someone drove from their house, committed the shooting in the city, and then went back to their house. Ideally, I have a map that shows that entire path at different times that's easy to understand. And then I have an expert that can explain it. because unfortunately I can't testify myself.
Maybe it's just because I live with a toddler, but I'm picturing you with like a really big pad of paper and some like jumbo crayons in different colors, just like drawing things.
There's a lot of that. Yeah. It's kind of like that Always Sunny in Philadelphia meme.
Day one with all the red string. I love that meme.
That is our life in criminal law.
That's how I felt when Kate Middleton went missing.
Yep. Absolutely. That's a big one too.
Okay, so what are some examples of how you've used this data in trials?
Yeah, so I had a trial, and this was actually one of the ones that Eric Perry from the FBI helped me on. I was in the domestic violence unit for about 3 years. That's where most of my recent work has been. And I had a case where it was a shooting. Thankfully, no one died. And it occurred in North Seattle. And this woman had broken up with her boyfriend, was with another guy, and they were asleep. It was like 6 a.m. The ex-boyfriend came in. He broke into the apartment. He had a mask over his face and he had his hood up. So none of the security cameras could really give us enough identifying information about who it was. He walked in and he pointed his gun at his ex-girlfriend and the other guy in bed, and he fired and he shot the other guy in the head. Thankfully, it only hit the other guy in the ear. And then our shooter ran off. Normally, this would be easier to prove, because ideally, the woman is going to recognize her ex-boyfriend. But in domestic violence, even in cases involving exes, our witnesses don't always cooperate. And this was a case where the woman would not admit that the shooter was likely her ex-boyfriend. And so we knew it was probably him. He kind of looked like the person on the videos. It made sense that he would have the motive to do this. And so we did a search warrant using his cell phone number to get his cell phone location data. And it showed exactly what I was describing before. It showed him at his house prior to the shooting. It showed him driving to the scene of the shooting. And then it showed him leaving down to the second at the exact times that we have the man breaking into the apartment on the security footage. And so what it did is it helped us solve the case. It helped us go over burdens that would have previously been hard to go over when we have an uncooperative witness and a video camera that was not good. And it ultimately helped us be successful in this case. We were able to prove it at trial. You know, even when we didn't have the rest of the case in ideal circumstances with witnesses and videos. And so that just kind of shows how incredibly helpful this stuff can be. And law enforcement officers did that warrant right after the shooting. And they found that information out basically the next day. And he was arrested the day after that.
Wow. And so
it's an extremely powerful tool that can be used to catch people and also solve crimes.
Is there anything a person can do on their phone to keep it from reporting that data or to wipe that information?
Yeah. So
I don't know if you're allowed to talk about that.
I hate to give advice to prospective criminals, but
I'm not a prospective criminal.
All someone would have to do is turn off their phone.
Yeah.
And it's that simple. Now, many people committing crimes want their phone on, whether it's for navigation purposes, which we're all kind of reliant on now, or if it's, you know, we have cases where people are literally Googling what to do next, like what do I do with a body? What are extradition laws in these countries? People do that kind of stuff. So people are just addicted to using their cell phones, but a sophisticated criminal would not take their cell phone with them. And then this data would not be helpful at all to law enforcement.
So take note, Bree.
I know. Noted.
So those are all the ways that you can use this data, but what about its limitations? What can you not get from this data? What does it not prove?
Yeah, so we always have to recognize that this information only shows us the location of a cell phone. It doesn't show us where a person actually is. So an even more sophisticated criminal might give their cell phone to someone else, and it might, or trade phones with somebody, and it would show the wrong person's location data. It also doesn't tell us anything about motive. It doesn't tell us anything about why someone committed a crime or whether they shot someone in self-defense, which are issues that are often even more important than proving identification. So often it is a narrowing of the issues. It's eliminating things that a defendant can argue in a criminal trial. Because if we have their cell phone location at the scene of the crime, they can't argue that they weren't there. And while that's not everything, that's pretty helpful in kind of narrowing what the decision is going to be for the jury.
Can you also use it to corroborate things like intent, like someone who drives from their house to a scene, murders somebody, and then drives back home? Can you use that driving window to kind of corroborate intent, or is that stretching it a little bit too far?
No, I think that can absolutely be helpful too. You know, it definitely shows, let's say someone, you know, left their home, took a 10-minute drive, was there for 2 minutes, and then drove back. That's not a random occurrence. You know, that's something that somebody planned, went to at a specific time, and then fled from. And so someone's path tells us a lot too about the decisions that they're making. I also just like showing paths. It's a lot more interesting than showing one ping on the dot. It's interesting when people move around. I think those are the most interesting cases.
There are some kind of common defenses that defendants might bring at trial, you know, self-defense or identity problems, things like that. What are some other common defenses that you see, and how does this data affect the availability of those defenses to defendants?
Yeah, so it's kind of like I was saying earlier, the first thing we have to prove in a criminal case is that we have the right person. We call that proving identity. And there's a lot of cases where we can't prove that. You know, someone might be wearing a mask. We might have witnesses that are not cooperative or might not recognize the defendant at trial. And so this helps us prove identity. This helps us get over that hurdle, which is a significant hurdle, but it's not everything. So like in going back to the example of the ex-boyfriend shooting the new boyfriend, it eliminated identity as a defense for him, but he still could argue self-defense. He could still argue that he shot the person because he was in fear. And that can still be a very convincing argument. There's no data that can show us whether someone's acting in self-defense other than testimony. And so that's what a lot of our cases end up being about when we know who did it.
Do you typically use other data on the phone to also help you with understanding motives or intent, like, you know, pictures or text messages and things like that? Or are you just kind of looking at the raw numbers, the data from the spreadsheets?
We do. So this goes back to what data we can get. For most of the other data, and what I call content data from someone's phone, like text messages, photos, Google searches, we need the actual phone. And so sometimes we don't know where that phone is. Often, thankfully, people are arrested with their cell phone in their pocket. And if they're arrested with their cell phone in their pocket, we can seize that phone with what's called a search issue to arrest, or search incident to arrest is what it's called. So then we get that phone, and then we have to do a different type of search warrant to get into that phone. That's called a phone dump. And again, we can't truly dump the phone. We can't get everything. It has to be narrowly tailored to what we want. And so we can get someone's search history, but only for a particular day. We can get someone's text messages, but only to particular people that we name in the warrant. But that information can be incredibly helpful. But then there's also third-party companies that hold this data sometimes. And when I mention third-party companies, I'm talking about Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram. Those are all companies that we can send search warrants to get content that may have been deleted from the phone. And so we do those kinds of warrants too. And those companies work just like the cell phone companies. They have their own legal departments. They respond to the warrants, and they have a business custodian that comes out and testifies for us.
Do you ever find that this is an iterative process? So like, you might get an initial warrant, get part of a phone, like part of a phone dump, and then be like, oh, actually, we need to drill down into this specific area and issue a subsequent or apply for a subsequent warrant.
Absolutely. It's sort of like what I call like a Russian doll effect. We could have a warrant within a warrant within another warrant. We've had cases where there's, you know, as many as 20 search warrants on one particular case, all authored by one law enforcement officer, maybe all related to one or two phones. I've had cases where there may be like 7 or 8 people that we want the location data of. And that creates a ton of different warrants. And so the kind of the key is to work with someone in law enforcement that is motivated and is actually going to do this stuff. One of the hardest parts as prosecutors is we can't do everything ourselves. And so we need their help. And so if I want to write 20 warrants on a case, I better have a good relationship with that police officer so that we can do this together, because we need each other.
So are you making Christmas cookies at holiday time to deliver to these police officers?
We have meet and greets with coffee and donuts, and we all get along.
Oh my God, that's so stereotypical. I could die.
Yeah.
All right. So what about victims? Like how does this cell phone data help you when it comes to working with victims?
It can help us corroborate a victim's story. And it can do that in a couple ways. You know, you can think of a scenario where a victim knows who shot them, or a victim knows what they saw, and maybe someone breaking into their house, they know who it is. We can corroborate that by showing the location data of that person. We've also had cases where a victim has been kidnapped and taken away, and maybe they don't know exactly where they went. We can find out where they went. We can find out their path as long as their cell phone was on and as long as the defendant's cell phone was on. We can prove that where they went, that they were together, and we can show that. And that can be incredibly powerful testimony. That's showing us something that the victim doesn't even know.
All right. Well, thank you, David. We've done a really great job of, I'm taking credit for all of your insight. You've done a really great job of outlining, you know, what the data is, where it comes from, how we get it, how it's used in real life, and how it helps to achieve the end goal, which is hopefully justice. But what are your thoughts and opinions about the future? What do you think the future holds for cell phone location data, or any data-enabled devices for that matter?
Yeah, so I think we can already see what's going to happen in the future. We have so many devices that are tracking everything about our lives. And one of those is our cell phones, and the others are the wearable items that we have, like Apple Watches or certain types of bracelets. Then sometimes we upload that information onto other apps, like how far we ran or what our heart rate was. All that information is potentially important for law enforcement in solving some cases. What I feel like is that law enforcement is still catching up to all the things that they can legally obtain, because there's so much out there. There are, you know, my phone probably has over 50 apps on it, and many of those apps have data.
That's it? Over 50 apps?
Keep this slow.
Boomer.
But for example, you know, we look at Facebook, we look at Google, we look at text messages, we look at location. There's all these other apps that have information, you know, maybe about your heart rate, maybe about what your workout schedule was a certain week. All these things could be helpful. And so what our job has become with working with police and detectives is really sitting down and becoming creative. What do we need to prove, and what information can we find and have access to? And who do we need to talk to that really knows how this stuff works? So what I think the future holds is law enforcement getting smarter and more sophisticated. And while that does sound scary, you know, of course, this is all information that's private. For me, as someone that works in law enforcement, it's going to make us better at finding out what the truth is. It's going to make us better at holding people accountable and corroborating victims' stories. So I think all this, as long as it's done lawfully, can actually be a really positive thing.
Well, and making sure that you aren't prosecuting the wrong person or the, you know, something like that.
Absolutely. It's just like, you know, when we got DNA evidence in the late 90s, they were able to find out some people were wrongfully convicted. The more information we have, the less likely we are to make a mistake like that, because that's the worst possible outcome that can happen. For me, as a prosecutor, I want all the information I need to make sure that we're doing the right thing and doing justice.
I've heard you mention several times today the people you rely on to help you, the people that are interpreting reports, the people who are the experts in the courtroom. What do you think the future looks like for folks who are like, man, this sounds really cool, and this actually makes a huge difference in the world for the, hopefully for the positive anyway? I want to get involved with this. Like, what career opportunities and what skill sets do you feel like would be important for somebody to understand who might be interested in getting involved?
Yeah, I think there is, from what I know, there's absolutely space right now for people to become experts in cell phone location information. We've gone as far as flying in FBI agents from the East Coast to come in and testify because we couldn't find someone who was an expert who could use this software and could explain this stuff. And as far as the barriers to entry in becoming some kind of consultant for this data, I don't think they're actually that high. You'd have to learn about how this stuff worked, maybe from a law enforcement, you know, training program. But the key thing is having access to this software. Once you have access to the software, which is not actually very hard to use, it's as simple as dragging things into a box, something that we can all do. It spits out data. I think that would be the key, is knowing what you're talking about and having access to the correct software. And I think there are going to be a lot of people that become their own consultants and experts in this area soon.
So what is this software exactly? I mean, what does it do with the data that you feed it?
So it's basically a mapping software. It takes all these spreadsheets with all these columns. It uses the latitude and longitude and the timing and everything. And it spits out a map with a bunch of points on the map. And we have to do a couple things to clear it up, to zoom in, to take off points of data that are not relevant and important. But it creates what is the start of a finished product just from these spreadsheets. So it's incredibly useful. I think the people that invent these kinds of software are kind of geniuses and really ahead of the game, because they knew that law enforcement would need this stuff.
Yeah. So I asked you earlier how I could stay off the grid. Now, do you think that people are going to get smart in the future and, you know, learn what how they're telling on themselves, essentially, and change their use of cell phones or other types of devices? Or do you think that this is just a really an increasing trend and you're going to see more and more and more?
You know, it's an interesting question, because, you know, as we sit here, you know, we're talking about all you have to do is turn off your cell phone and law enforcement won't be able to tell where you are. But in my job, again and again, we find that that's not the case. You know, a lot of crimes are committed not with years or weeks of planning. They're committed maybe with a couple hours or a couple minutes of planning or no planning at all. So what we found is there has not been a sophistication to this. Inevitably, someone will be smart. But thankfully, this isn't the only point of data we have. There's also an incredible amount of videos that exist now. Mm-hmm. All around all of our cities. And so if we can't get someone's location through the cell phone data, my next thing is to hope we have a video of something, which we have a lot more of these days.
All right. So let's close this out with a mental health corner, because David, you have a big job and one that's especially emotionally and psychologically draining. I mean, I stopped working with you because, not because of you,
because you're emotionally draining.
I mean, it was too much for me. I couldn't handle it. The roles that you've had, I mean, working with sexually violent predators and domestic violence victims, these are some of the most ghastly, disturbing crimes. And you've seen some of the worst things humans have done to each other. And yet you're still a really balanced, grounded person. So how do you do that? How do you find that balance and look after your mental health?
Yeah, I think one of the craziest things about my job is that as you get more successful and as you go through the office, the stuff that you handle gets harder and more traumatic and crazier. And so sometimes success creates more stress. And that's something that I definitely found in my work. But as people working in the legal profession, I think a lot of us are overstressed. A lot of us work too much, have unreasonable expectations put on us. So what I've done, thanks to my amazing wife and partially thanks to our experiences during COVID, is we've started backpacking. So my wife and I, we go on between 7 to 15 backpacking trips per year. I do them almost every weekend in the summer. And it's a really cheap trip. My cell phone is off. so my bosses can't find me even if they want to. And we go on these great big trips. You know, I find that when I'm only focusing on a couple of things per day, where we're going to camp and what we're going to eat, it really calms me down. And so I actually recommend it to a lot of other people. I think this is how I've gotten through this stress. It's been really helpful. And we got so into it that in 2022, we hiked the Pacific Crest Trail together, which is a trail from Mexico to Canada through California, Oregon, and Washington. And I think that's those experiences have only made me a better attorney. It gives me something to look forward to. I meet people from everywhere and I just get some peace in my heart and my body that helps me get back to work every week.
That's amazing.
So David, that first of all, that's amazing that you guys are hiking in the woods and still married after all this time. No, I'm just kidding. But no, thanks for sharing with us your tips and tricks for staying balanced. And I know that I mentioned this to you when we talked about you initially doing this show in the first place, but I do want to mention this because I know that I'm not alone. And I also want to encourage folks that are in this field. Although we kind of like to joke around and have laughs and talk about potential crimes that Angie's going to commit, we actually do very much appreciate folks like David and all the people who support David and trying to find these individuals out there who are creating crime and honestly, you know, changing people's lives for the negative. I had a situation where when I was a child that I was kidnapped. And that's been something that was terrible to live through, but is something that's affected every single day of the rest of my life. And I wish that we had more technology back then so that maybe I wouldn't have to think about all the other little girls in the world that were affected by the sick person that kidnapped me. And I hope that that's not many, but I'll never know. And I appreciate you, David, so much for staying balanced and for your hard work in this field and your contributions. And I appreciate you sharing your expertise and your wisdom today. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Bree. And thanks for sharing that. I think I'm very lucky and it's the least boring job in the world.
That's the truth. All right. Thank you for joining us today on eDiscovery Chicks. We hope you learned something new, felt empowered, or just had some fun along the way. Don't forget to join the flock by following us on LinkedIn and Instagram and check out our website, ediscoverychicks.com. If you loved this episode, share it with your network, leave us a review, or tag us on our socials with your favorite takeaway. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Catch us next time when we tackle breaking down workflows to maximize your efficiency. Until then, flock on, friends.
The views we express today are the eDiscovery Chicks views and do not necessarily represent the views of our employers, partners, or clients. The podcast is available solely for educational purposes, to provide general information about eDiscovery principles, and not to provide legal advice to any specific situation. It is not a substitute for legal advice from a lawyer you've retained and who has agreed to represent you.